Well, good morning. Does the calling make the person, or the person make the calling? In other words, if your parents call you gifted or smart or even stupid, do you and I live in compliance with that call and become what we're labeled? It's a question for psychology and psychologists. Or do each of us, by choices to exercise or not exercise our talents or brains or opportunities, become gifted, smart, or yes, even stupid? That is, do we choose, do we make the call? For those of you who watched the Super Bowl this past year, you know that Philadelphia Eagles quarterback Nick Foles was named the most valuable player of the game as the Eagles defeated the mighty New England Patriots. What many people watching the game wouldn't have known is that a couple of years previously, Nick had almost quit the game of football, considering becoming, believe it or not, a high school youth pastor. And then, this year, Foles was languishing on the bench when the starting quarterback went down with a torn ACL in his knee. The coach looked over at him and said, in effect, "Nick, I believe in you. Lead this already good team to greatness." And Foles took up the challenge. He believed. That is, he set his mind to living the call. He became what his coach called him to be when all the other coaches had given up on him ever becoming a top-level NFL quarterback. The calling gave him the opportunity, but Nick Foles made the calling come true. It was 1980, and Diana Spencer was still in her teens, educated and raised in privilege. She was very shy and didn't really have a set direction in her life. Then, as most of us know, a very interesting suitor came calling, Prince Charles. Their love was, as we now know, a mix of heart and duty. The real passion of Charles' heart, Camilla, not royally sanctioned in those days. But be that as it may, the call to become Princess Diana was met by an incredible determination on Diana's part to make herself a princess, as she became a champion of the downtrodden and one of the world leaders in the fight against landmines. At the heart of our scriptures is this burning question: what might human beings become? It's a question. There's no certainty about an answer. There's no determination by God to issue a divine fiat that says, this is what humans will become. Rather, there's this dynamic interplay between God's call, human response, and/or human desire, and God meeting that desire. It would appear that God initiates the relationship with Abraham and Sarah in our first reading, way back in the Ur of the Chaldees, and then many times subsequently, as we saw again in our first reading today. But they were also the kind of people who were willing to take up the challenge. If you go through the amazing story of this pair, and I'd encourage every one of you to do it. It takes probably about 30, 40 minutes to read from Genesis 12 through Genesis 25. And in those chapters, you'll see that they undergo 11 challenges. Some of them experiences of God's appearing. Other challenges are more moral in nature. More, their interactions with the nations around them, their interactions with their children are extremely challenging. most of the challenges that they undergo would probably have been too much for a person like myself. I'm a bit of a wimp. But the question is a real one then. Was it the call of God who made Abraham and Sarah the founders of monotheism, or did their desire for God, for the one God, predating Greek philosophizing, by the way, by 1500 years, did that lead to God revealing the divine nature to them? Did God call them to monogamy, or did their extraordinary love for each other, of course there is the Hagar incident excepted, initiated by Sarah, we remember, did their love for each other help rediscover it? Their kids, by the way, didn't seem to get the memo. They just reverted back to what everyone else was doing in their time, which was polygamy. Paul's answer to the question in our second reading, what might humans become, is that it depends both on God's promise, that is God's call, and faith. Our deep, tenacious, stick-to-it faith, our answering of the call. And that both parts, the whole dynamic messy reality, the opportunities given to us, the responses that we might make, the calling, the faith, the failure, the ongoing challenges and struggling to understand, all of that is grace. All of that is what it means to be a human being. Now let's think very carefully about this next one. Did God's call of Jesus make him the Messiah, or did Jesus have the incredible gumption to believe he was the Messiah, and so God partnered with him and he became the Messiah? Before you think I'm veering off into hopeless heresy, understand that I value the creeds as tokens of trust, as Rowan Williams, our great former Archbishop of Canterbury, has written. But what I'm interested in when it comes to our lives, when it comes to the life of our parishes, is the dynamic question, what might human beings become? And Jesus was nothing if not a human being. We didn't need an angel in our midst. We needed a flesh and blood human being. And so all the messy dynamic of call and response, promise and faith, mistakes, and even change of mind are at play in Jesus as they are in us. If the New Testament is not mere play acting, then the first scene of our gospel, where Peter calls out Jesus as the Messiah, is something that Jesus needed. Not just Peter and the followers, not just us. Sure, there was the baptism of Jesus where he was affirmed by this heavenly voice. And we've talked about that several times in the Epiphany season and, of course, in the first Sunday of Lent. Sure, there were the miracles happening. But Elijah had performed miracles, as the crowd rightly noted, one of the reasons they were identifying him as the reincarnation, if you will, of Elijah, was the kinds of miracles Jesus was engaged in. Jesus, though, as the former Anglican bishop Nicholas Thomas Wright, considered one of the world's great New Testament scholars, has noted in all of his books, had a deep inkling of who he was called to be, but he needed spiritual experiences and validations. Validations, by the way, not just from voices that came from heaven, but from real flesh and blood human beings that were like him. He needed those along the way. He needed, as we do, to be called and to be called again. But that's on the one side. On the other side, Jesus becomes the Messiah. by forging something that no other early would-be messiahs, and there was a bunch of them, by the way, including others named Jesus, by forging something that no other early would-be messiah had thought of. That the Messiah, if he is truly to be the Messiah, must not simply play on the received human plane of power politics. My sword against your sword, my army against your army, which of course was the great expectation of the Israelite, of the Jewish people at the time, that the Messiah would come and on the political level, on the economic level, get rid of all of the oppressors, particularly the Romans. Jesus becomes the Messiah by resisting this received path to messiahship. Like Abraham and Sarah, he's willing to challenge the deepest wisdom of the world and say the firmest no. He believes there is a deeper, a better, a more God-shaped path, even if it involves his death. This explains the dynamic at play between Jesus and Peter. Peter helping Jesus, reaffirming the call, saying, yes, you are the Messiah. And then Peter acting as the perfect foil, again helping Jesus craft the messianic journey so that it might truly be one that has a chance of getting to the root of human evil and not simply buttressing the status quo, reifying the structures that are already there. And so when Jesus tells, or when Peter tells Jesus that he must not go to Jerusalem to die, it is the perfect opportunity for Jesus to recognize the different way he must go, and even if he has to put Peter in his place. Mark's gospel draws all of this out by bookending the story, our gospel reading today, with two powerful Roman realities. The first is that Jesus and the disciples are headed towards the villages surrounding Caesarea Philippi, a city built, as the name suggests, to celebrate Caesar's power and divinity. Peter's confession of Jesus' messiahship would have, on the face of it, been a direct challenge to that power and divinity. For in Peter's mind, as I've just suggested, the Messiah would crush Caesar and restore justice to Israel. As they're walking towards the city, there would have been crosses, Rome's ultimate intimidation weapon, dotting the countryside. If indeed Mark's gospel was the first gospel to be written, right around the time of Israel's insurrection, 70 AD, then Mark's Judean readers would clearly understand what's going on in this story, for they would have noticed in their neighborhoods, on the hillsides surrounding Jerusalem and other major cities, hundreds of crosses. It's how Rome did its business against all those who opposed her. Sights of untold suffering, signs of warning, don't challenge us. But to Jesus, the crosses were a call. To his messianic vision, they were a call to go deeper. A deeper understanding of what it will take to answer the question, what can human beings become? The way to answer that question is to first ask, what do you fear the most? Do you fear the pain the oppressor can cause? Do you fear death? Do you fear suffering? Normal fears, of course. But Jesus, in effect, poses a counter question. In his call to take up our cross, he poses an implied question. Do you fear becoming what you fear? Because you should. If the Messiah simply takes up a sword and defeats these crosses, The Messiah simply becomes the new Caesar, the continuation of the status quo. And then the followers of the new Caesar become, in effect, the new centurions, the new oppressors. And we see this happening over and over again, where a new regime overthrows the old with promises of everything being different, and before long, everything is just the same. But what if the Messiah and his followers see the cross as call, as promise, even the greatest opportunity? What if the Messiah and his followers take up their greatest fear? That is, face it, even see it as the ultimate possibility. Would that not turn the world upside down? Would that not allow Caesar's power, any tyrant's power, you know, even our own inner tyrant, to be defeated from within, from underneath, if you will? What if it's possible, Jesus seems to be saying, to live increasingly free of fear, free of shame, and so gain the only thing worthy of God's call and all our ability to act, becoming truly alive to human potential, becoming truly alive to God and our partnership with God? What Christ makes possible by calling us to follow him is not yet probable, unless that call is met by our own call to act in courage, by our own courage to become the call, to become fully alive, to wake up to our complicity in evil, to celebrate the challenges in our life and parishes as opportunities for growth. This past week, we witnessed the high school students of Florida called by their equivalent to the cross. The brutal deaths of their classmates, the senseless deaths made possible by the cynical logic of interest groups and governments out of touch. They have chosen to take up this cross, to face their fear and become more fully alive to the social realities around them. They're taking the risks of being labeled agitators. Indeed, threats are being made about not being allowed into the university of their choice if their name and their face gets out there too boldly, too visibly. These are young people who understand more about this text that we've looked at today than many of us adults do. But be encouraged today. Peter, Jesus' friend, goes from encouraging Jesus to being called Satan by Jesus. Now that is something not even the wardens have called me. He does not yet understand what I'm weakly fumbling towards in this homily. But Peter will. And God willing, and through the exercise of faith, so will we. This Lent, God calls. Will we have the courage to become the call?